November 11th, and Gabby Dinman and I am going to be interviewing Mr. Lincoln Mazzell, and Gabby Dinman is going to be taking the notes. And this is the Pittsburgh section of the National Council of Jewish Women, oral history. And I'm doing it, I did it in reverse, so that's okay. We're doing Mr. Lauren Mazzell.
Nothing.
Excuse me, Mr. Lincoln Mazzell. God bless you. At Gateway Towers. Gesundheit. That's okay.
Thank you.
And we are in the library of the building at 16 at Gateway Towers. This is really okay, Mr. Mazzell.
Yes.
What I would first like to hear about you is your very early family life, where you were born.
Well, I was born in New York City, February 12, 1903. I don't remember, of course, the exact the experience of being born, but that's the record.
And your parents?
And my parents were born in Russia. Both parents born in Russia. My father was born in Poltava. My mother was born in Kharkov, and they came to America in 1900. They came with one son, a brother, an elder brother, who was 3.5 years older than I. And shortly after my father's arrival in America, he was a violinist, by the way.
He was a
violinist.
A violinist. Okay.
He started out to be a concert violinist, but when he was about ready to start, his father died. And as he was the eldest member of the family, it was his job to take care of the family. So he became a professional musician in Russia. And in those days, no Jewish child was even allowed to go to Moscow. However, if a Jewish child was very talented, he could enter the university, the conservatory, the music conservatory, which my father did, and he was appointed by the Tsar to be the concertmaster of the Tsar's orchestra. And he actually played at the Tsar's wedding. About a year after he came to this country, he was engaged by the Metropolitan Opera House Orchestra to play in the orchestra, and he stayed there for 20 years. That's the first violinist at the Metropolitan Opera House Orchestra. And for my eighth year, I was exposed to the opera, the Metropolitan Opera. I used to go to the operas. My first opera was Hansel and Gretel. Father to take me.
And your brother too?
No, he never came with us.
Was your brother older or younger?
Yeah, 3.5 years older.
Than you?
He has since passed away. He reached the age of 91. He was a country pianist and appeared in America and in Europe extensively.
What was his first name, Mr. Mazzell?
Marvin.
Marvin Mazzell.
Marvin Mazzell. He appeared with several orchestras in the United States, with Pierre Mortier, with Tchaikovsky. And another conductor, his name is Gibson.
And your mother?
My mother was not a professional woman, although she had a beautiful voice. She loved to sing. She was not a well woman. Lost her, she was quite young. She's a music lover. And just like my father was a mentor for 20 years. I became interested in singing as a very young boy, as a matter of fact. I had a natural voice. And the New York World, which was one of the prime newspapers at that time, was holding a competition. Select a number of highly talented, gifted young people to perform. The prize was to perform at the Schubert Theater one night, which was a very big thing. The auditions were spread over a whole year because it's New York City. They interviewed over 90,000 young people. 90,000, well, New York City. And they selected 30 people, 30 out of the 90,000. And limited to, you couldn't do any encores, you just do one number, whatever it was. You could be singing, playing, dancing, narration, reciting, whatever was the talent. I happened to be the only singer, the only male singer on the program. And I was lucky enough to be selected for that.
How old were you then?
I was 16.
And how much training had you had by then?
None whatsoever.
Just your natural voice?
Yeah.
And what did you perform?
I had the nerve to sing the Vesta Lajuba by Lachi. That was my favorite because I heard him do this. And I have records of it. And he was my idol, you know.
Did your father help you and your mother?
No, my father didn't even know about it. I never told him. And as it happened, when the performance took place, he was traveling every summer. The Neapolitan would go to San Francisco, to the coast, to give performances. My mother was in the hospital at that time. I never told her. I was a closet singer. When I was home all alone, I would sing. As soon as anyone came in the house, I'd shut up. Nobody knew that I was singing.
That's unbelievable.
I just, you know, that's not an uncommon thing. There are closet poets, you know, closet actors and so forth. They're self-conscious about it. They don't think they're any good. And they don't want to be ridiculed. You know, a lot of things involved in that idea.
So you won. You performed.
I won the 30.
What was it like?
Well, it was a sort of experience. You see, you're so excited doing it that you are only aware of your own performance in this. And I couldn't give you the... I couldn't tell you what anybody else did.
But you did have a chance at the Schubert for one night?
Oh, yes.
And
oh,
what
yes.
did you do there?
I sang the best of my Schubert.
Oh,
and wow. I was the only one that they wrote about in the paper.
Why?
Well, and they had a little cartoon, as they called it. They said that I showed great promise to be an opera singer, you see. It was an exciting experience for me, and of course I was sad that my father wasn't there, but then I kept the news from him. And we had a housekeeper at the time, and I told her, she was the only one who came to the concert, by the way.
Your housekeeper?
Your housekeeper, yes. My brother was also away. He was 19 then, 20. He was playing someplace.
And did you finally tell your dad?
Yes.
What was his reaction?
Well, he was kind of puzzled. He was really more involved with my brother. He taught him piano and got him started on the piano. I also took side on the piano. I didn't have that kind of musical talent. Anyway, on Halloween, you know, in New York, are you familiar with New York?
Mm-hmm.
You know, those apartment houses, they have a courtyard downstairs. You go into the yard where children during Halloween used to sing or perform in the yard. And people would throw down money. It was just a thing to do. The young people at that time to perform, who could perform. And I was once singing in one of those yards. And some woman, a friend of the family, recognized me and told my father, see, that I'm singing in the yard. He didn't know anything about it. So then he became interested and he got me a teacher. Some woman, an Italian woman, who was connected with the Metropolitan.
You remember her name?
I couldn't tell you that.
Mr. Mazzell, who was the director and the conductor of the Metropolitan Opera?
Toscanini was the main conductor. I remember him very well.
And your father worked under him then?
Yes, and they became a good friend, by the way. An interesting story about that. One day, while they one time when they were going to California, Toscanini had a compartment on the train. And he called my father in there one day. He wanted to talk to him about something. And what he wanted to talk to him about, he showed my father a score of a symphony, which he, Toscanini, had written. He said, "You see the score?" My father turned and said, "Watch what I'm going to do with it." And he proceeded to tear it up.
Okay.
A score that he had written, you know, a symphony score. It involved an awful lot of work. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I have no talent. This is terrible. What I wrote, it has to be worth it." So he tore it up and threw it out the window.
Oh, my.
Now, you know, he might not have been his best judge, you know. That happens also. The composer is not always the best judge of his work. To illustrate that, for instance, in another instance, when Tchaikovsky went to a performance of his Sixth Symphony, which is considered his best symphony, and when he came home, he was very dejected. He wrote a letter to his brother. There's quite a collection of his letters that he wrote to his brother, Moritz Tchaikovsky. He said, "Moritz, I'm through as a composer. I have no talent." Went to hear my Sixth Symphony. Oh, the people of Portland, they know me, they like me because of what I did before, but I'm through. I hear, you know, this great work. He's completely disappointed with it.
Amazing, isn't it? We all doubt ourselves regardless.
Yeah, you just don't, you have to have a certain talent to be able to recognize talent, even if it's through your own.
Are you able to evaluate your own talent all the time?
Yes, because I've been exposed to good singing, for instance. And I know when it isn't good, and I know when it... And any dedicated musician, be composer, pianist, or whatever, they know they had a good performance. They can tell you every mistake they made. Because they are more aware of what they're doing than anybody, because they know the music. Much better than the critics. The critics, you know, first, very few of them are musicians. Very few of them can even read a score. However, that doesn't mean that they don't have good judgment. That's something else again. You could have good judgment, a certain instinct for good music. And you can express yourself that way.
Who would you consider a good critic of your time?
A
good critic. Do you have any critics that
you... Today I don't know of anyone... I haven't read criticism for so long now. Lord stopped reading his criticisms, as many other conductors also, because there's no one anymore, for instance, you wouldn't think of a layman watching a doctor perform an operation. you wouldn't expect him to make some comments on it or describe it or criticize it in any way. You have to have that kind of talent in order to be able to judge it.
Do you know of any critic that has the ability to judge?
Today I don't know of any. That doesn't mean they don't exist.
Were there any in your memory?
I remember Bruno Usher from Los Angeles was a wonderful critic. But his criticisms were always constructive and always bringing out the fact that it's one man's opinion. And when you think that, take the repertoire of a conductor, any of the classical repertoire, symphony, Tchaikovsky, Brahms, Beethoven, Mozart, there are many conductors who conduct that music. And many of them do it very well. But each one does it a little bit differently.
It's an interpretation, isn't it?
Yes, because the reason for that is that everyone is different. For instance, a simple thing like making it louder or softer. How much louder? How much softer? Everyone does it a little bit differently. So the critic, if he likes it done one way, he has a tendency to criticize anything else that isn't that way, as if that's the only way. But there's as many ways as there are people who interpret. And each one, I mean, assuming that they all are dedicated and following the instructions to the best of their ability, they're all doing the very best they can. So they're all for their own understanding of it. And it's going to be different. However, there's always when the interpreter starts imposing his own personal interpretation, changing. If it's louder, so he makes it softer. If it's softer, he makes it louder. Well, those things are frowned upon. You know, they have no right to do that. And that's where a critic can criticize with intelligence. Otherwise, and unless they know the score so well, they're not qualified even to do it.
So what is the merit for a critic?
What is the what?
What are the merits for a critic? Is it the newspapers?
Well, I'll tell you. You remember Demas Taylor? Does that name mean anything mm-hmm. to you? He was a composer, American composer. He once had a radio program. And he would answer questions people write to him. So one question was, it was asked by many people, who hires a critic, the music critic on the newspaper? He said, the city editor. What does the city editor know about music? Deems Taylor says, nothing. So that's how they hire these people. They have to have a critic. And they don't know. They can't judge. In a sense, from a high level, they're superfluous, for the most part.
And you never read your son's, you don't
not
read?
Now, no.
Was it painful if it wasn't a good critique in the early years, or?
Well, you're somewhat annoyed. But you realize it's a personal opinion. He hasn't read it for 25 years. And many of the other conductors also. Monteux, who's a friend of ours, also a great conductor, doesn't read it. Because, again, and that field, in the conducting field, where it's so highly specialized, unless a man can read a score and has good aesthetic judgment of some kind, he's not qualified to make a judgment. That is a serious judgment. He has perfect right to express his opinion, you know, that's something else again. But not to in such a way that that's the way to do it.
The expert.
That's the thing, you see. This is the way to do it. There's no such thing. There's no such thing.
Okay, we sort of left off with your performance at the Schubert, and you were 16 years old. Where did you go from there?
Well, I went to take some lessons, and since I was studying, you know anything about the voice? Well, the principles of any kind of music instructor is the same. You start on scales. In singing, you start on vowel sounds. Well, I was already singing operatic arias, you understand. And the idea of doing exercise, I couldn't see that at all. And I, at the age of 16, I was pretty self-willed. And that didn't appeal to me. I didn't want to take those kind of lessons. It was stupid on my part and ignorant. But my father didn't insist. And then later on, I found some other teachers in California. I went to California when I was 21 years of age.
Why did you go there?
Well,
excuse me 1 minute. I'm sorry to back you up a little bit. What was your schooling at this time? Were you going to school?
I went to school. I went through high school. And then I quit high school in the third year. And my father thought it would be a good idea if I would study pharmacy. So I went out to coach and study pharmacy. We had a lot of doctors and pharmacists in our family. Well, I'm not a scholar. And pharmacy is quite a very important subject. And you have to have a talent for that sort of thing, which I did not have. My wife had it. She was a pharmacist.
So then did you drop out of pharmacy school?
Well, not right away. One of the things that you do is to try to get a job in a pharmacy. And I did get a job in a pharmacy of a hospital. And while I was there, one of the salesmen who used to come to the pharmacy and selling the pharmacist's equipment that he needed to have, talked to me about selling hospital equipment. And it appealed to me at the time that I could make a living that way. And I went into that. And I was doing very well with that. I even opened up my own business after a while. And then,
how old were you then?
25.
What took you to Europe?
To study voice. Until
did your wife encourage it?
Oh yes. She used to play the piano for me. And I never did have a good teacher. I didn't know the tenor voice is a difficult voice. One of the early forms of teaching was by imitation. You take a note and you try to match it. That's the simplest way. That's the method used on teaching anything. You do it. You show how it's done, do it. However, the singing, again, every voice is different. And there are certain sensations that the singer feels in his head or in his body. And those sensations differ from singer to singer. So,
if the teacher takes a tone, a beautiful tone, he is feeling or she is feeling certain sensations in his head, which if you try to imitate it, you may take the same pitch, but you will not have the same sensations because your face is different, your head is different. And unless you have exactly the same condition in their body that you have, that she has, or he has, you're not going to match that tone. See?
So voice is almost like an instrument, isn't it?
It is an instrument. And it's already there. You don't have to do anything to it, but just develop it, make it stronger. But then you have to know certain things, what to do. For instance, the high notes, to know to get a good high note properly, you have to open your mouth pretty wide. Otherwise, you'll never make it. And then depending upon how the structure of your jaw, some singers have to open their mouth wider than others. If you have a square jaw, you don't have to open your mouth so wide. If you have a rounded jaw, like most people have, you have to open your mouth wider. You ever hear Jessie Norman?
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever watch her mouth when she opens
it?
No.
Now I will. Now every time somebody sings, I will.
You know, she's a big woman. When she opens her mouth, you think you can walk right in there. She opens it to get the full value. I'm talking now about the upper tone, particularly. Anyway, it's a... it's a very difficult profession from the standpoint of the teacher, how to be able to recognize a good tone and not to have to say, this is where you have to feel it. When they talk about placing the voice.
So it's up to the teacher to direct and know the potential.
Yeah, to give you an example, I had a pupil come to me with a very fine baritone voice. He was leaving another teacher. And I said, why are you leaving him? Well, there's a particular sensation I have when it feels very good to me, and I feel it, the sensation on the back of my head, which I never heard before. It's unusual. So I said, every time I do that, and I tell the teacher I'm feeling it in the back of my head, he said, no, that's not right. You shouldn't feel it there. So I had him do an exercise, and I stopped him when I had to hear that good note. Where do you feel that? At the back of my head. Well, then keep it there. You know, if it's a good tone, you leave it alone. You leave it alone. Nature's doing it. You know, nature is the teacher. You're not telling nature what to do. So he's very pleased with that. And he had a really beautiful voice. It's an unusual thing to do. Usually you feel it in the front of the head. I've never heard of anyone, I haven't heard of any since here, feeling in the back of the head. But what's the difference? There's a difference between, you know, that's a major difference. You want to hear any more of this?
I want to hear about, you went to Europe, I'm assuming you went to Paris.
Yeah, I went to Paris. That's where Lauren was born.
Okay. And when was Lauren born?
In 1930, March 6th.
And how long did you study voice in Paris?
About 1 year. But again, I had a teacher who was a tenor himself. Still a young man, about 35, Spaniard. He had to stop singing because he had heart trouble. He was already singing in the opera. But he had to stop. But he would take a note from me to see, and he would tell me where he was feeling it. But his voice is not like mine. Mine was not like his. So I could never get those high notes right. Because when you're told where to put it, you know, when you think of it, and if you realize how small the area is inside, how are you going to direct a note in that particular specific place? You imagine, you know, you think in the front, or the up, high, middle, whatever, but it may go there, it would be a miracle if it goes there to that kind of thinking. It has to go there by itself. And if you're doing the right things, it goes there by itself. If you don't interfere, you see, trying to direct the tone is already an interference. Because how can you say that you're directing it correctly?
Can you give us an example? Would you sing? I mean, could you possibly just give
us... Well, I don't know. My voice, you know, I'm 91 years of age. And I'll just finish it. Now that is a fairly good tone. Now, if I would try to make it bigger or darker, I was suddenly now interfering with the production. See, so I was to get flat right away. I was depressing.
Inhibiting. Yes.
Now, for certain kind of interpretation, that would be